You're listening to Sound Poetry. I am your host, David Gilmore.
You're listening to Sound Poetry on Radio Tacoma, KTAH, 101.9 LPFM. I'm Steve Niebel. I'm sitting in for David Gilmore. Today we have Seattle poet Benjamin Schmidt. He's gotten a Best Book Award nomination for Dinner Table Refuge in March of 2016 and a Pushcart Prize nomination for the poem Table in November 2015. He's published 4 full-length books of poetry. He's been a host and curator at the Inkwell Reading Series in Seattle from January 2016 to May 2018. He's a performing poet and a teacher. We're pleased to have him on Sound Poetry today. Hello, Benjamin.
Hello, Steve. Thanks for having me.
I found the titles to your books really to be very intriguing. The most recent one is The Saints of Capitalism. My first reaction is I don't usually think of capitalists as being saints.
Yeah, no, that's definitely an interesting reaction. So yeah, the title actually comes from a sermon I heard by a pastor, because I guess in the evangelical Christian tradition, they believe, different than Catholicism, that everyone is a saint, basically, right? Like in Catholicism, there are certain saints and there's a whole process for that, you know, canonizing somebody and doing all that. But in some churches, they just have the idea that everyone's a saint. And so it's really where the idea of the book came from. I had the idea many years ago that capitalism in the United States has become more of a religion, honestly, than just merely an economic system. And so I thought, well, if we are in this religious system, you know, and we're all participating in it, then we could potentially all be saints by that definition of it. And so the book was really just a way for me to investigate the lives of people who, you know, live in the capitalist system and kind of all across the spectrum, rich and poor, and also chronicle my own life as taking part in this. Yeah, it was a fun process.
I find that really interesting. It's a great title in that regard, because I'm sure a lot of people, if they see it in a bookstore or something, will just pick it up. They'll go, huh, a book of poetry about the saints of capitalism. You know, is this... this is intriguing. So, and then, of course, if you have something that's good in there, then maybe they'll buy it. So why don't you read something from it?
Yeah, I'll read one of the first poems from it. This is called Conarchy. And a conarchy is like a monarchy, a system of government, except this is a monarchy to be a system of government run by a monarch. Conarchy is a system of government run by a con artist. So, conarchy. Hustle, hustle, con, con. Con, con, hustle, hustle. Hustle, hustle, con, con. Con, con, hustle, hustle. Pastor Mike with the con, con. Buddy, give me the $5 in your wallet, and I'll give you $1 that will transform into the breasts of an angel after 90 days. Marlene Needler with the hustle, hustle. I guarantee your old shoes have gold inside of them. You need to hoard your gold. My dog Sparkles can lick those laces right down to the nuggets. Mad Dog Murphy with the con, con. Listen, amigo, you need to stop reading books and plant your extra time on the side of a mountain. A grove of saved trees will grow, filled with wood nymphs. Jonathan Clark with the hustle, hustle. I know it looks like we gave your job to a robot, Paul, but immigrants stole it. They're climbing out of beer cans. They're invading North Dakota. Rainbow Richards with the con, con. Sure, your professor has a few fancy degrees, but can she tell you how snakes evolved from toothbrushes? How horses are made from snow? Well, St. Lulu can. Dr. Orchard with the hustle, hustle. Our research proves that staring languidly out of a window for 30 minutes a day can help a person build the meaningful relationships they will have to ruin to get ahead. New website with the con. Toiletism. A term describing jokes meant to mock a person's bodily functions. Example, making fun of my farts again, Joe? You're such a toiletist. Mary Higgins with the hustle hustle. There's a hot new press marketing poetry collections to drug dealers. Each book is hardcover and contains a space inside the back cover with enough room to hide a stash. The prestigious council with the con. Don't worry, aging is no longer relevant to us. You're not getting older. The fat of your paunch will rise upwards to smooth out the wrinkles on your face. Senator Barry with the hustle hustle. Of course this is a democracy. We just can't let you vote this year, Anaya. If you vote, that will make it less democratic for everyone else. Hustle, hustle, con. Con, hustle, hustle. Hustle, hustle, con. Con, hustle, hustle.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
That had quite a bit of truth in it. But also, it was a... It did make me smile, I'll say that.
It's one of those poems that I wrote, and I've been really looking forward to reading it because it has a lot of rhythm in there, and it's kind of fun to do just with the musical components of it.
That's right, it does. I don't think that I've heard anyone recently read with such a rhythmic finesse. It's a lot of sarcasm.
Yeah, I mean, I try to do a lot of the book is satire, and I had a lot of fun with that, and I think it was a way for me to kind of process a lot of what was going on, what's still going on, you know, in the country over the last 7 or 8 years, really, you know, and I feel like a healthy way to deal with that and to speak out about some things that really concern me is through satire.
Right. I've had that inclination myself. It's what can you do? Have a good laugh about it. You know, it seems so absurd what has been going on. The way that the world goes, it's not like anything that's happening is necessarily all that new, but it's new to this particular time period, at least to the extreme extent that the politics have been. Let's go ahead and roll on to another poem.
Yeah, I'd love to. So this is a poem from the second section, which is the title section. So that's called The Saints of Capitalism. And this poem is called Honor. To address me, they say, Your Honor. The robe, the bench, the gavel, relics in this holy temple of capitalism. And I too am honorable, went to the right schools, succeeded in the right jobs, married the right woman, had the right number of kids, helped the right people, asked the right people to help me. Every door is big enough for honor to pass through. But is mine the honor of the tiger or the zookeeper who feeds him? Where is my honor at 3 a.m. when thoughts shinny to rooftop murders? Where was it the night I held her down and forced her to touch me? Was it honor itself that allowed that night and all the nights after? I have inhaled honor like the secondhand smoke of a cigar while playing golf with senators. Honor is what keeps me in this wealthy community. It means I don't have to shake the hand of anyone who bothers me. Today, a disgraced nurse was in my court. She told us that she was ashamed of what she'd done. Her hands were shaking like in an ancient dance or rite. But what I want to know is, where did she get so much honor?
Was there something specific that inspired that?
Yeah, so do you remember in 2018 they had the big Brett Kavanaugh confirmation hearings.
You bet.
And so there's all that in the poem, but there's a specific moment that inspired the poem, which is So I think senators can like invite people into the audience of those hearings. One of the parents of a victim in the Parkland shooting, it was that school shooting in Florida. One of the parents from that shooting was in the audience. And so, Brett Kavanaugh had his, all they were interviewing him, all those questions, and he got up. I think they were like on a recess or break, whatever they call that there. And he stands up and he turns around, and that Parkland dad is in the front row, and he put out his hand, and he to shake his hand, and he introduced himself. And Brett Kavanaugh looked at the guy, didn't shake his hand, and walked away. And I just thought that was, and that's where like I guess the pun of the poem comes from. Like you're someone we're gonna call you Your Honor, and yet in this moment you lack honor. You lack the ability to give another human being respect, especially when someone's so vulnerable that they're literally reaching out to you, putting their hand out to you for recognition, and you denied them that. It really stuck me, and it really kind of showed me what kind of person that was, and made me angry. And the poem came from a lot of anger, but I hope I toned that down in the poem. I think it doesn't sound too angry to me.
Yeah, I think you toned it down. It doesn't sound too angry.
Thank you.
But do you work in specific forms, or when you write, or do you just write very spontaneously? And do you ignore formal forms of poetry, or how do you do that?
Yeah, I've actually written in formal poetry. This book doesn't contain a lot of that. But in previous books, I've had, I've written a couple sonnets and a sestina, and so for me, that process really just comes out of what the poem is trying to tell me. Because initially, when I just write, it's just me kind of going crazy in a notebook, and I just basically my process is I just keep a notebook for 9 months or a year. I have this kind of phases where I'm feeling like I really. I don't want to call it a burst of creativity because it's not like I'm inspired, I'm going to go write. It's like I have to go and sit down and I have to set aside that time. But there's like a 9 month period or a year period where I'm like, okay, I want to try to work on this and just create some rough drafts and see what comes out of that. And so in that process, yeah, it's really just notebooks. Once I wrote a sestina and I had like all I had, and it worked out because it was like I had 4 lines, but I had some really good words. So I was like, oh, cool. I can like shift these words around and make a sestina out of it by repeating, these 6 words throughout the poem. Yeah, when it comes out, there's not even there's no stanzas for the most part. It's just like, just all lines of poems. And I even, change lines and I'll add I'll cut off lines and I'll add punctuation. There's no punctuation when I'm just writing in a notebook for the most part either. It's just kind of it's a very, very rough draft at first.
So you have The Saints of Capitalism. So you did a thematic book that has this theme of the Saints of Capitalism, which you explained earlier. You have done these books that are thematic, this one in particular, The Saints of Capitalism. And did you end up with a bunch of poetry that you couldn't use in the book during the period of time you were writing this? My question is actually, did you actually come up with this title, The Saints of Capitalism, and write around that theme? Or did you just end up with a group of poems that fit that idea?
That's a really good question. A lot of times, like the title, so the title will come to me at different times throughout the process. Sometimes it's come before, and so it'll be like soundtrack. My third book, Soundtrack to a Fleeting Masculinity, that was I had just kind of an obsession with modern misconceptions of masculinity, and so I wanted to kind of explore that. This book, I really went through a rough time in my life, like in 2018. And was just really struggling with some things, and so that really kind of created this burst of poems. But during that time, I was also just very disappointed with a lot of just things in society around me, things that I just felt like were very cynical and cruel. And I kind of felt like that was connected to, you know, the saints of capitalism, this whole idea of this being a religious system that encourages a certain beliefs system, a certain way of thinking, a certain culture. And so I had, you know, a lot, so the poems were, they all kind of reflected that to some degree, I think, those concerns that I had at that time. And so the title came maybe like halfway through writing it, because I was like, oh, you know, we're all the saints of capitalism, as I was kind of telling these stories that I was noticing and even discussing my own life.
I reiterate, I love that title. So let's go ahead and have another saint of capitalism here.
You mentioned in the intro that I'm a teacher. So this is actually a poem I wrote. It was inspired by a poetry workshop I teach, and it's called Workshop. What can I teach a class that remembers the Kennedy assassination and the Korean War? Their faces look to me like stones, seen through a crack of poetry. A little distorted, but a little more real. Their voices burn like candles, steady flickers of passion, discussing the stanzas we study. I am neither teacher nor friend standing up here. They are all hunters, and I am merely the barking dog leading them to their game. What a pleasant excursion upon the downs, finding a Dylan Thomas refrain in the shrubbery. Like the dog, I'm an emissary of wilderness, chewing on bones of imagery, sniffing the poetry of the roadside. I love these people. One is lining up the memories to shoot in his mouth carnival. One confronts the evil that swayed in the long grasses of her Iowa prairie. One flees a drunk in the shrieking alarm of his fingernails. One battles the fires burning his attachments. Cultures bicker before the bishops, turning vendettas into verses. But somehow, we understand the trench coat grins in each other.
I get from that you were teaching a class of people who were older than you.
Yeah, I taught at the Bayview Retirement Community up until the pandemic, you know, just for safety reasons. But yeah, I taught a poetry workshop there for about 7 years. It was a great, great group of folks.
It seems like older people become poets in their elder years, quite a few people. Some people decide that they want to be an artist in their after they have given up their day job, you know, which kind of intrigues me. It makes me wonder about the role of artists and what does it mean if can everybody find their inner artist, you know, and if so. Are people who are trying to take themselves seriously as artists diminished by that fact?
That's a great question. I think, for one thing, you know, I just want to say my favorite part of it was actually introducing a lot of the folks in the class to poets, especially poets from their generation. You know, so that was fun because they didn't know, like, they really loved Tony Hoagland, who was a baby boomer poet. And but they really loved his work, and it was just funny to me because they really related to it well, and but then they would also relate to poems I didn't think they would, and they were very open, and they would even love poems that were very new and written by younger folks, and so that was very encouraging to see. As far as your question, I do think that everyone can be creative. I just think everyone has different roles in that. When I'm teaching a class, for me, it's really just about people having a place to express themselves. And that kind of goes with the theme of the book in a lot of ways, because I feel like there's not a lot of spaces left that are just community spaces. What I loved about it was facilitating this place that we could all come to and share our lives. And even if, you know, from a technical standpoint, it wasn't a complex poem and maybe even have some problems with it, it was like, the person who wrote it in that moment, they felt empowered. So I do think everyone has the capability to be creative. But like I said, I think it serves a different purpose for everybody.
So this was just one retirement home you did this in, or did you do it in several?
I did it at the Bayview Retirement Community. It was a really fun experience. It would be interesting to do it again somewhere else. We were just lucky, and we had a group of people that really connected with each other, and they just felt safe talking about things that they may have never told someone before. And so that really was moving to me.
So they wrote poems as well as you were introducing them to poets. So you did both things as part of it.
Okay. Yeah, it was generative, yeah.
Let's move on to another poem.
Yeah, I'm going to read one about my daughter. So it's called Accomplishment. At the park, my daughter climbs to the top of the slide, her teeth bared tenaciously with something greater than will. Her force of a face pushes its way through. Tiny hands grip pieces of plastic. Boots find footholds as she scales this pretend peak. On her back, I see lines of transformation, like national borders imposing a vision upon a continent. When she reaches the top, I cheer her down the slide. She tells herself, "Good job," and I laugh at the self-congratulation. She climbs a few more times. Skateboarders scrape words from pavement. A basketball bounces, clangs a giraffe off the rim and bounces again. Dogs prance by, pulling slavish owners by the leash. What lasting mark will any of us make with our little fists clenched? There is no violence like inertia. The sun finds a way to break through the leaves, catching me with a single ray.
Oh, that was nice.
Thank you.
Did you have your notebook with you that day?
No. It was one of those life moments, you know, like if you have that, you're like, this is great. You know, and I didn't have anything with me. I was just there with my daughter. It was kind of this great moment of happiness. And fortunately, you don't get a lot of those in life, but I was just felt really fortunate to be there with her in that moment. Yeah.
So then later when you sat down to write, that moment reappeared and found its way onto paper.
Yeah. And she has a very strong personality. She's a very unique child. Her name is Lorca, after the poet. And she kind of reminds me of Cher because she has a very original name, and she also has a lot of hair and a lot of personality. And so I'd been meaning for a while to really write about her, beyond just her being my daughter. She's just a fascinating person to study as an artist. You know, like I feel like a painter would love to be around her because she has so much movement and she's so vibrant, you know.
Well, you know, I wanted to hear something from your soundtrack of Fleeting Masculinity. That's another one of those titles. And you said that you, did you say that you actually did take these and write to that title, or was that once again the title came after you had just written a group of poems that fit the title?
No, so as a child, I was obsessed with records, and then I was also obsessed with movie soundtracks. From like my childhood, you know, 80s, 90s movies. I really kind of combined both of those things. And so I really wanted to kind of make an ode to the soundtracks I grew up with that I think probably inspired me in some ways. And then also just my dad's record collection was also something that made me want to create things, you know, just having these beautiful objects there that contained these songs that were really life-changing and awe-inspiring for me. And so, yeah, this was a title that came pretty early on, if not before all of the poems I wrote for it. The book itself was kind of set up around that title. Each poem in the book is actually a different track number. So when I wrote them, they had no titles and I didn't want any titles at all because I was just going to give them track number titles to kind of go with that theme. And then the book has two sections, side A and side B. And I'll go ahead right now and read track 68 from side B. One Halloween, I put on black lipstick, a black dress, a few sprays of expensive perfume, and became the hottest girl at the party. A football player even asked me out in this halfway house between the sexes, refuge from my libido, short stay in a long body, without want. My curled hair and eyelashes enticed me into resting from enticements. My shaved legs were the smooth sheets that the children of a thousand genders wrapped themselves in as they slept. Every preacher wants to be a writer and have their thoughts endure. Every writer wants to preach to us in a way nuance won't allow. Maybe men want to be women, and women want something better than a man. Men move through beds and all the dark tunnels between them, only able to remember a fleeting masculinity in their stumbling. The beds soon become unrecognizable from the tunnels. There is no manhood on the sweating stones. I apologize to the women I've used and wounded. I wouldn't know what it is to be a man without my time in drag.
Was that a real incident? You actually passed as a woman to some of the guys that were at the party?
Yeah, this is Halloween in 1997 or 1998. And I had a friend who really wanted, I had long black hair in high school. I was kind of into, heavy metal music and punk rock music. I was in a couple of bands. And at that point, I was kind of writing songs, too. So, yeah, I already had, the long black hair for it. And so all I really needed, was a nice dress and some makeup. And a friend did that for me. And I really did get hit on, and it was hilarious.
These days with gender going in so many different directions in terms of people's consciousness, it really actually is a very complicated and interesting subject. And I suppose that one of the aspects of that subject is that generally our society wants to take gender and put it in a box.
That poem was probably written when I was early 30s.
So long after the incident.
Yeah, but those last lines in there, it was really just me having that incident, but then also just trying to come to terms with ways that I'd participated in being a man that were not healthy. And I wanted to kind of confront that honestly, just to kind of move past that. And kind of like you said, not adhering to these really outdated, archaic structures of what it meant to be a man, but trying to find my own place and really just embracing who I was, which, includes a lot of masculinity, but also includes some very feminine moments. I think that's great, to be honest with you.
I'm sure that you came up against some people who wanted to question your masculinity because you had long black hair.
Well, yeah. I mean, this is Pocatello, Idaho. So this is Southeast Idaho. Yeah. There was the religious conservative culture there. And so, at one point, actually, four buddies and me, we decided we're all going to wear dresses to high school. And they kicked us out of school. Well, they kicked three of my friends out. They didn't kick me out. And I really think it was because I looked good in the dress. it was they didn't catch on. Nobody reported me. It was weird. But my buddies all got suspended. And then my parents picked me up from the library like, what? What's going on?
That's good. So why don't you read another one from that book? Please read another one from that book.
So I'll read track 29. Potential lovers loom like mountains on a night train bound for the capital. But even to love one person is to love many and hate more, along with love itself. Poets grow out of love like a limerick thrown underhand or a bib that catches free verse before it gets on a shirt. And thus many return to love in later years. I want to love her now, despite these prestigious poems of pills written by professors with tenure on the line. I want to love all the sugar of the evening breeze. I want to love the nuns that whisper in her dimples in the place where Facebook can't find us. I want to love the tractor plowing the ethereal fields where our eyes meet. I want to love the Hollywood remake of us, its lack of substance and an adequate cast. I want to love the pretentious critic from Dallas who follows us around, mocking our ability to parallel park as a team. I want to love this no sex life thing because maybe that will lead to a sex life thing. But every time I bring up sex, we don't have it. So maybe just ignore this part. But how can I ever stop? I want to love the decades that have moved in with us. The 70s with a junk habit, sleeping on the couch. The 80s bogarting the bathroom, making real estate deals on an enormous cell phone. The 90s slamming doors and playing music too loud. The zeros hiding out, hoping the bill collectors just give up. I want to love, but does wanting poison loving? If you want it, can love even exist? The irony of a landscape laughing at your enormous hands is no place for the kind of love we need in modernity. It is easy to want nothing in a place where no one lives.
Did you say a limerick thrown underhand?
Yeah.
What is, how do you throw a limerick underhand? That, I don't know, that line just kind of got me, you know, a limerick thrown underhand.
Yeah, I guess
the whole limerick, you know, what are there? There's usually six or eight lines in a limerick, you know.
It's a limerick softball league, yeah. I
really like that. Could you read the last couple of lines again?
Sure, I'll read the last five because they all kind of go together.
Right.
The irony of a landscape laughing at your enormous hands is no place for the kind of love we need in modernity. It is easy to want nothing in a place where no one lives.
It's easy to want nothing in a place where no one lives. Actually, it seems like you would want something in a place where no one. I think of like a desert, you know, or up in the mountains or forest where nobody lives, you know. I can think of a number of things that you'd probably want. That's a really interesting line, though. The big hands. That's pretty fun stuff. I think it would be fun if you recorded the whole thing.
Yeah, well,
with a side A and a side B, you know.
I need you to play some music on it.
There you go.
That'd be fun. We'll put it on vinyl. I have a pretty good vinyl collection right now.
Yeah, so people do that. But I think that's a really an interesting idea to number them all like their tracks off of a record and actually have a side A and a side B. Do one more.
Sounds
and
great.
And wrap it up. We're talking to Benjamin Schmidt. Why don't we go back to The Saints of Capitalism to another poem from there? Can we do that?
Yeah, I could read a poem from the final section, which is called The Tyrant Cycle. So,
okay.
And just a little background on that. The Tyrant Cycle is a poem cycle describing a historical cycle, a historical pattern. And so there's 16 poems in it, each describing a different phase of this historical cycle. It's a historical cycle that chronicles how a country would slip into authoritarianism. So I'm actually going to read the final poem from it. And this is number 16, Death, in which a nation cannot withstand the excesses of an authoritarian and finally gives way to something new and better equipped to face the challenges of its time. They burned the cities before they left them. Fires pressed upon the blackness like backstage hands upon a curtain before it is raised. A cackling wind stirred the flames and witches' bowls of ashen muck. Colorful posters of the emperor quickly shriveled to black and white like spectral fundamentalists. Houses and storefronts burned together. Luxury cushions violence, but bought by violence, luxury must return to its own violent end. They walked to the hills, stripping off their clothes as they went, each falling shirt or sock an act of repentance, putting on the plain cassocks the people had made. Billboards and mannequins interrogated their fashion status from afar. But what did they care now? The Emperor's party had tried to stop them, had tried to find a leader to belittle or mock. But the people had seen deer spring from the mouth of God and mountains inhaled through his nostrils. There was no leader in their belief system, and they knew the Emperor's party had no belief system beyond their leader. An entire nation had been murdered, and they had tried to fill the borders with a single foolish man. And so the people walked away into the night. Christian, Muslim, liberal, conservative, citizen, immigrant, black, white, woman, man, cis, trans, elderly, and infantile, wearing their cassocks, greeting a once conquered land as a once conquered people, all became free at morning's first light.
Wow, you took on a lot there, I thought, anyway.
Yeah, the tyrant cycle. It's kind of a narrative because it describes the slip of a country from, you know, being democratic to sliding into authoritarianism. And so, there's different phases of this process, like I said, and each poem kind of chronicles that. And sometimes from a different person's perspective, sometimes from kind of a collective perspective. So.
Well, Ben, it's been great talking to you, and thanks a lot for coming to Sound Poetry.
And, thanks for having me, Steve.
This is Sound Poetry. I'm Steve Niebel, sitting in for David Gilmore. We've been talking to Benjamin Schmidt, a Seattle poet. And thanks again.
Thank you.